Hey everyone, welcome back to Drive On. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and today my guest is Dr. Josh McConkie. He is a colonel, an author, an emergency physician, jack of all trades. He's got it all. but he's dedicated his life to the service of the military community, transforming his own experiences into high impact solutions for those in need. And today we're going to discuss his experiences, his motivations, and learn how to handle the numerous stresses that come with serving in the military. And before we get into that, I want to welcome you to the show, Dr. Josh. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Scott. I appreciate it.
Yeah, absolutely. So your background is in emergency medicine, which, you know, that takes a special kind of person, I think, to be able to handle the unexpected, the unknown. You have no idea when you walk into work, what is going to be thrown at you, because by their very nature, emergencies, they just get thrown at you, right? So
yeah, I've always been a big adrenaline junkie, so I get bored super easy, so I got to stay on my toes or I just get bored.
Right, exactly. And I would imagine a lot of people who are successful in emergency medicine have to be somewhat like that, because things just are always being thrown at you, right?
Yeah, it's just managing chaos all the time. It's crazy.
Yeah. So how do you see this, your background, impacting your abilities to handle stressful situations that come with military service, and not just military service, but also the emergency service? Like, how is it that you're able to kind of hone in, like, when that chaotic thing happens, how are you able to focus on that one problem? Or is it like you're juggling 10 things at once and you're just doing the best that you can with what you have to work with?
Yeah. You learn to compartmentalize. You can only deal with one, maybe two, like, real emergencies simultaneously. You get task saturated, so you're juggling lots of different things at once. But as far as like real crazy emergent type stuff, like one or two simultaneous, anything more than that, it gets a little bit overwhelming, and hopefully you've got a good team around you. Right. But with the years of service, so I spent the first 9 years in the Army, the one combat tour in Iraq, and that taught me a ton, coming back to civilian life. It was a struggle to come back, which I know you've had a chance to experience yourself, but mm-hmm. when you come back from a combat zone, it's kind of hard to plug back into normal society again. Mm-hmm. A lot of listeners out there can certainly relate to that. But you just got to learn to compartmentalize and just take one emergency at a time, unless it's super crazy.
It was so weird when I got back from Afghanistan. Actually, I was home on leave. We had like a 2-week leave, and so I was home, and it was kind of mid tour, and so I came home and I was with my wife. We walked into a store and I just had a panic attack. I was like, "Where's my weapon?"
Yeah,
what happened? Where did my weapon go? And I'm in Walmart. I was gonna say you don't need it there, but you might need it there, but. but I was like, it's not like the end of the world. I'm not missing anything. Everything's where it's supposed to be. We're good to go. But it's just like that readjustment.
Those little jarring moments. Yeah. I had one when I had just met my wife and we were driving in a car. I had just kind of dozed off and there was like this whistling. There was a train and there must have been some screeching brakes, but I was kind of half asleep and I jerked awake because it sounded like some incoming rocket fire. And I just looking around, it took me a couple of seconds. Like, no, I'm in South Florida. Everything's okay.
Yeah, right,
just some of those weird sounds that just kind of catch you off guard, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And so these things happen. And I think a lot of the listeners can probably relate to, what you're talking about, what we're talking about here. Now, I do want to get in a little bit into your military experience. Talk about your deployment and some of the things that you experienced and that you witnessed. What are some of the most impactful things in your life that you've seen through that experience?
Yeah, probably the biggest change for me, the thing that I noticed is, you grow up in America and it's, everything is, some people get really tied into how much money you make or what kind of car you're driving. And I was in Iraq in 2007. I was there for the surge, right? Mm-hmm. And they shot down 8 helicopters in 2 weeks just before I got there. The day I landed in theater, they shot down one of our helicopters. And I was flying medevac. I did one air assault. And the first 2 weeks I was there, I was kind of paralyzed with fear. You know, they were shooting down all these helicopters. There's mortar fire coming in. And I called my cousin, Zach, who's a special operator. You know, he's a Green Beret. And Zach, I think I'm in real trouble. I think I'm going to die here. And he said, well, you know what? It's the best adrenaline rush of your life. And once you get over that fear, I just figured, like, listen, nobody cares what kind of car you drive. Nobody cares how much money you make. Nobody cares how big your house is. Like, you have a mission to do here. That's like live or die. And I was flying, you know, medevac and taking care of men and women that were taking bullets for this country. And there's no greater honor in that. And once you kind of just get over that fear of death, it took a couple of weeks. It was pretty freaky, but you know, you drive on, right? You move past that and you get things taken care of and you let your family know back home, hey, I love you guys. And it's actually pretty bad here, but it's okay. I'm here because I want to be here. And I love y'all, you know?
Yeah. You know, and that's a good perspective too, because yeah, sure, bad things can happen. Absolutely. And I think we all kind of come to peace with that when we are deployed, you know, especially when you first see stuff that happens and bad things that can happen. But, you know, you're talking about like, you know, the type of car that you drive or the house that you live in and all these things that, you know, we, as a society here in the States, we look at those things like, oh, that guy's got a nice car. He must be, you know, super successful. He also might be drowning in debt because he can't afford the car, right? Like there's two sides of that, right? But you know, when I haven't been to Iraq, but I know in Afghanistan, they are piecing stuff together just to get by. You know, they'll find parts of cars and they'll just transform it into something else. And it drives. It's probably not safe, but it drives, right? And like that's their way of life, and that is just normal to them, and they don't see anything wrong with it. And you know, but you go over there, and it's like just a culture shock seeing just the differences. There was one time it was like the body of a car, like the chassis and like the engine and everything, but it was just wood, wood panels, almost like if you were to strap it together, like if you're on a deserted island and you were trying to make a raft to get off.
Fascinating.
It was like that. And they just like stuck a seat to it and they were just driving. I don't know how the hell it drove,
hey.
But you know, but it's just different, right? It's just a different way of life. And even, you know, in that deployment, what we go through as Americans and, you know, any of the service members who are deployed from other countries, it's different than life here in America. It's a different mindset, a different attitude. It's getting through that mission, surviving, you know, living to the next day. And most people don't wake up and think about that. Like they take survival for granted, right?
It's very different. And we're pretty coddled here in America, and we're blessed, right? I mean, we have, you know, overall a level of security and safety here that a good portion of the world does not have, and we're very fortunate for that. But I think a lot of the everyday Americans really take that for granted. They really have no idea how the rest of the world lives.
That's right. Yeah. And there's just so much going on around the world that, you know, even, you know, love them or hate them, the media can't cover everything that's going on around the world, right? And there's just so many hours in the day, so many, you know, news stories that they can report on. So they pick the ones that they think are going to be the most impactful, the most, you know, important to the people who are listening. But yeah, you can't cover everything, right? So now taking your service and your work in the emergency department, what are some pieces of advice that you can share with folks who might be dealing with the stresses of military life or even just stresses of transition, you know, just stress in general? I know you're kind of the adrenaline junkie, but not everyone is like that, but or even needs to be like that. But, you know, what are some ways that you kind of cope with some of the stress that you deal with?
You know, just that resiliency is critically important. And as a military commander right now, I see a lot of the younger, like the 18 to 25 year old range right there that has struggled a bit with some of those resiliency and the stress levels just because of the environments that they were raised in. You had an entire generation, you know, that the Gen Z, you know, that COVID generation that was I mean, locked in their house for 2 years. You know, they were shut out of schools and churches and just not being exposed to different stressors to learn how they can cope and overcome and adapt with that. For me personally, it's always been physical exercise. I've seen some, just some horrible cases that would just churn your stomach. People do some really mean things to each other. Mm-hmm. And in some of the really bad cases that I've seen, I remember just coming home one day after a baby had passed away. So this was my first sudden infant death syndrome. And you just see how it destroyed that family. And the mom came running in because this was at Madigan Army Hospital. It was the very first one. So the mother was active duty, and the husband had come in with, you know, basically a limp baby, and we're working on it for, you know, a good half hour, an hour, and we're not successful, which is always hard, you know, itself, but you're very focused on the academics and doing the procedures. And then the mom comes running in, just kind of just screaming, "Hey, where's my baby?" And then you just see everybody break down and cry. And, you know, we're all crying as well. It's so hard. But for me, I went home that day and I just went for a long run. I just ran myself until I felt like I was going to throw up. It's kind of hard to be too stressed out if you're throwing up on the side of the road. So you just, for me, it's always been physical exercise and then leaning on a strong faith. You know, without my faith, I don't think I would have survived Iraq at all without a strong faith. My chaplain, Jim Higgins, just very integral in my life. Mm-hmm. He was able to show up on my assumption of command, you know, 2 years ago, which meant a lot to me because he's dealing with a lot of health issues now. And, you know, just, you know, faith, family, and exercise, that's how I've done it.
You know, I think those are all important pieces. You know, when you're exercising, I know there are some days I don't want to get out of bed. I don't want to go to the gym. I don't want to go for a run. I don't want to do any of those things. But I'm like, you know what? Screw it. I have to do it. I know I have to do it because if I don't do it today, I'm not going to do it tomorrow. And if I don't do it tomorrow, I'm not going to do it the next day. And it's going to continue that trend. So yeah, I'm like,
I get real grouchy if I don't work out.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's not that afterwards I feel like a million bucks and I feel wonderful and awesome and everything, but I feel better than I would if I hadn't done it. Right. Sometimes you run yourself until you want to puke, and that isn't exactly the best feeling, you know. But you know, also to your point, you know, it's hard to, you know, still be stressed out when you're trying to keep your lunch down or, you know, whatever. You know, it just kind of changes the perspective and maybe brings you into that present moment and, you know, helps you understand like, hey, you know, yeah, this was a terrible situation that went on, you know, especially with that child and that family. But life does go on, and you standing on the side of the road, puking your guts out, like that's proof that life continues. Right. Mm-hmm. And you have to keep putting one step in front of the other, you know, one foot in front of the other. And, you know, realizing, hey, I do have a family. You know, for a lot of us, we, you know, we do have families, and that's an important aspect as well to remember. Hey, if I'm not getting up, what kind of example am I setting for my kids?
Yeah, just my three kids. I think about it all the time.
Yeah, exactly. I don't want to be this, you know, grouchy, lazy, you know, couch potato, whatever, in front of my kids. I want to show them, you know, the values of, you know, hard work and, you know, good work ethic and, you know, putting the time in to take care of yourself and all that kind of stuff. I want to show them and kind of lead by example with that. And if I can't do that, well, who's, you know, and my wife, if we can't do that, then who is, right? And they're going to learn from somebody, and I would much rather be me, right?
Yeah. You know, and then even sometimes it's just doing it for the men and women that don't have that opportunity anymore. You know, some of those men and women that gave that ultimate sacrifice. I carried those body bags, you know, off of helicopters. And, you know, I think a lot of times, like what I do is I feel like I'm doing it for those men and women that don't have that opportunity anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't forget them.
No, absolutely. And those people, you know, I think about them all the time when it's like I'm on a run or something, and it's like, oh man, I just want to quit. I just want to give up right now. It's like, well, yeah, but there's somebody else who would have traded everything just to be able to run Absolutely. Another step, right? and they don't have that opportunity. So I like this perspective that you're bringing to the table here. And you know, we didn't talk much about faith, but I think that is something that it's a lot of times very personal to the individual. But you know, faith I think can drive you a long way as well.
Mm-hmm. That can be something different for everybody.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. But you know, without it, and you know, a hope for the future, and you know, hope for things, you know, that are better to come, and all that, you know, then it's almost like what difference does any of it make, right? And then so without that, it's like then you start spiraling into some darker places. And
yeah,
so,
absolutely. You get to have that kind of just some overarching theme in your life, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you're talking about some of the younger folks that are under your command, mm-hmm. and some of the struggles that they were having. And I hadn't thought about it until you brought it up, but the COVID era, you know, the folks who were locked down for a couple of years, you know, we're a few years out from that now. And some of those people are now of the age to be joining the military. They're on the younger side for sure, but, you know, they might be struggling with some of that. And I hadn't even considered that until you brought that up. But I was looking at the Department of Defense released a little while ago their statistics on suicide numbers in the military across all the branches. And overwhelming majority were folks in their 20s, give or take. You know, it was, you know, mid to, you know, upper 20s or so. It seemed like that was like the overwhelming number of people who were having these issues were in their 20s. And so it started getting me thinking. It's like, okay, well, there's obviously some issues going on there, you know, but I hadn't even made that COVID connection until you brought that up.
It's very important. It's something I see as a commander and as a physician. So that's what I do all day, every day. And in this younger generation, I see increased anxiety and the depression and unfortunately suicides. And it's just those years are so critical. I mean, you think of when, like, you know, when I was middle school, high school, just everything is awkward and goofy, and you're just learning so much about yourself and kind of where you fit in the world. And then you just turn it off for 2 years and you sit on an iPad and you just isolate yourself from other human beings. That generation, this kind of iPhone generation that's never known the world without an iPhone, had a little bit of difficulty with some of the basics of communication anyways. And then, so that was just a killer, you know, that whole two plus years right there. And we're seeing the repercussions of that now in our healthcare system, in our military, in, you know, we got a lot of work to do, you know, leaders in this country to get this generation, you know, help them out. That's what we're here for.
Yeah, exactly. And I think these are unfortunately some of the unintended consequences of, I think some of it well-meaning, you know, preventive measures so that people aren't getting sick and dying and all that kind of stuff. I understand, you know, where people's heads were at the time, but maybe not thinking long-term, like what is this going to do long-term?
Those second and third order effects that are always a little bit difficult to predict. And then sometimes you just can't predict it at all.
Right.
That's just,
especially when you have a issue like this, it was a global issue. It affected everybody from young to old and everybody in between, and people were just not sure of, like, how bad can this get, because we hadn't seen something like this you know in recent history anyways. And so what do we do? And so they erred on the side of caution and you know, didn't really know what was going to happen, because there hadn't really been any you know, prior history like this, where we said, okay, everybody locked down, like worldwide, everybody locked down. And
1917 flu pandemic. That was the last time we'd seen anything like that.
Right. Exactly. And so, you know, unfortunately history lessons maybe go, you know, unlearned or forgotten or whatever. But, you know, those types of things are, you know, hopefully this will be something that we keep a little more top of mind for future, you know, issues. Hopefully there's no future issues like this, but
hopefully, yes.
So talking about these younger folks and well, anybody really in the military, what do you think, is there anything more that can be done, within the military medical system to help, or you know, whether it's mental health or physical health, anything like that, to help the service members handle the stresses that they're dealing with while they're on the service.
You know, so them feeling like a little bit more detached and having difficulties with the communication, the earlier you can get them like ownership in your organization, in their unit, their squadron, and really feel like they're an integral part of that and that what they do matter, the earlier you do that, the better. Mm-hmm. So, you know, with that, just the basics of leadership, accountability, you know, trying to build resiliency skills, but just giving them ownership in your organization, you know, as soon as you can, because the more detached they feel or the less ownership that they personally feel, it's going to lend itself more towards the anxiety and the depression and the separation that just makes everything else worse. Mm-hmm. So we do a much better job of talking about it and discussing the mental health issues now. So that's really important, but trying to find what's the core issue and, you know, just their sense of belonging and their ownership is a huge part of that.
You know, you mentioned that, and it's something actually that we had done when I was serving. This is 14 plus years ago, you know, but something that we had done, we took, you know, some of the freshest privates, that were in our unit, and we would give them a task, you know, some training, task. And we'd say, okay, you go study this, make sure you're good to go. You know how to present, how to show us how to do it. And you run the training and you take it and you teach us. And sometimes like the best way to learn something yourself is if you have to teach it to somebody else. If you have to explain how to do something to somebody else, it helps you learn it yourself. And so that was the thought process back then, is help these guys get, you know, up to speed on whatever the task is. You know, it could have been some, you know, basic medical stuff. You know, we're infantry, so we all needed to be kind of up on that so we could do basic first aid stuff. Yeah. if things happened, right? And so we give them that task, and it's like, you go ahead and you teach it now, and you teach us how to do it, and you know, forget rank or anything like that. You're the teacher. You're leading this, and you know, I hadn't even thought about it from the perspective that you just said, of how that now they own that. They're the ones responsible for teaching that to us, and you know, gives them like a sense of purpose and a meaning. They're not just along for the ride, right?
Yeah, that was a great example. That's you must have had some great leadership there.
Well, you know, it was, I'm not taking credit for all of this. This was definitely, you know, kind of top down. It's like, hey, this is what we think we should be doing. And so we did it. But it was, I looking back at it, it was probably great from that perspective too, because it just gave them that sense of purpose and meaning, through those exercises. And they weren't, you know, the most complex things, but it gave them something to work towards and kind of build up their skills. A lot of them were, you know, 18, 19 years old. They had never instructed anyone on how to do anything. They, you know, they had just graduated high school, and they spent their whole life being instructed on how to do things, went through basic training and all that. They were taught how to do things. But think about it, like long-term, you know, if you're deployed someplace and, let's say the squad leader or the team leaders or the, you know, whoever, they get taken out somehow. Well, who's got to step up into their shoes?
Next man up.
Yeah, exactly. So you're going to have to step up whether you like it or not. You're going to be that guy. And so you're going to have to know how to do not only the job of the guy ahead of you, but maybe even two steps ahead of you. Hopefully not anymore, but you know, that's something that you might just need to get up to speed on pretty quickly, right? So
I love it.
Yeah. So let's talk about your book. The Weight Behind the Spear is the name of the book. Tell us about the book. What can the listeners take away from the book? You know, key takeaways and you know, anything that they that can help them in their life post military.
Yeah, you know, being the weight behind the spear, to really kind of understand what that means, you first need to understand the tip of the spear, right? So mm-hmm. I've been very blessed. I've got to work with some special operators, combat search and rescue, was medical director for PJs.
Okay.
You know, out there rescuing, you know, men and women down behind enemy lines. Some of them were called in to rescue those children that were trapped in the cave systems in Thailand in 2018, you know, and then some of these people are on these tier one teams, you know, kicking down doors and taking out bin Laden. I don't have those skills, clearly. You know, I'm an emergency doctor. I save lives. I don't take them. But the best resource that we have in this country, it's people. It's teachers, it's coaches, it's volunteers, families, you know, those mentors. Every single one of these special operators are just true heroes. And, you know, in most members in the military, I mean, we all have a job to play, and that we execute that mission, and that's what makes us the most powerful military on the planet. Every one of us has someone in our life that gave us the confidence to do what we do. Mm-hmm. Coach, teacher, you know, family member, you're one of your grandparents, like somebody. That's our best resource. We need to harness that resource to pick up this next generation. You know, when you talk military leadership, business leadership, just in schools, we need to take ownership of that, of just this last however many years, you know, for this Generation Z, this COVID generation that's lacking a lot of these skills, that has a lot to do with some of the decisions we made, you know, during that COVID pandemic. But we got to own that. We have to recognize there's a problem, because if you don't recognize the problem, you can't fix it. And then that ultimate ownership and accountability. That's what I love about special operations. Everything is their problem all the time, always. Like, yeah. It's like you own it and you adapt and overcome, period. You can't fail. The failure is not an option. And you own that problem. And, you know, that the book is really it's a call to action for Americans to get out there and engage their communities. What they do every day matters. And I want them to know that.
Right. And you think about that tip of the spear, you know, those special operators, the ones who are, you know, out there, they're kicking the doors. They're rescuing people. They're doing all the things that, all the sexy stuff that goes on, yeah. You know,
gets on the movies yeah, and books, right?
Exactly. That's where the book deals and the movie deals come from those guys. Which I totally get, because, you know, and you, I'm sure you understand it too, as an adrenaline junkie. It's like, that's like super high speed kind of stuff that, I mean, and not to, you know, discount, you know, anyone else's, you know, like what you do, for example, that's pretty high speed as well. It's just different, you know, it's just a different way of doing things. And, you know, split second decisions need to be made. You know, all these things, there's a lot of similarities.
Everything comes into play. If they're sports fans out there, everybody knows Bill Belichick, right?
Yeah.
Do your job. Your job. Everyone does their job. This team is successful, and we're going to get things done. So, you know, everyone can't kick down the doors and shoot Bin Laden in the forehead.
Right.
That's right. But there are hundreds of thousands, tens of thousands of people who are involved from like point A to point B, putting everything together, everyone doing their job. Yeah. And that's what it builds up to. So those guys can execute at that type of level. I mean, they can't do it without us.
Exactly. And I read somewhere that probably around the time that you were in Iraq, kind of around the height of the war, for every one boots on the ground, you know, infantry, special forces, those types of people, for every one of them, it required 8 other people, support, not non-combat related,
the support staff, logistics, everything. Medical, you know,
and you had mentioned this, earlier, is, you know, in the job that you do in the emergency, department, that you better have a good team. On your side, right? You're out there, and you've got your hands on the patients, and you're working with the patients, you know, in that emergency situation. But without the right support behind you, you know, you can't do everything.
If one person fails, like pharmacy, nursing, ancillary staff, X-rays, labs, you know, maybe not a critical lab, you know, like some serial lactates, or just there's a million different things that need to come together there. I can't do my job without everyone functioning.
Right. And that's kind of what I'm taking away from, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm taking away from what your book is talking about is, look, I can do only so much as a parent, right? But there's coaches maybe who can coach the kid to be a better, you know, football player, or, you know, what, maybe I don't know how to play football. I'm not great at that, but there's a coach who might be able to do that. And someone else can kind of step up and do that. And teachers at schools, and, you know, all these different people who, kind of help build up, you know, that community and help people, you know, raise the best next generation to kind of take our place at some point, right?
Yeah, that's what's great about having, you know, some of that diversity in your community. Everyone has something different to give. Everyone has a different skill set. You know, some people can coach. Well, I played some baseball. You know, mm-hmm. I did not get to play much football because I weighed 112 pounds in high school. So I was a wrestler. You know, learned a lot that way. You can't play football at 112 pounds unless you want to get absolutely destroyed.
You become the football.
Yeah. Self-preservation there. I didn't play football, but everyone's got something, you know, different skill set. Somebody that just really loves animals, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that volunteer work that you do at those animal shelters, and then that animal becomes a support animal for someone out there that's, you know, working with some mental health issues. Everything comes together when everyone does their job and they have something different to give. So, you know, it's a lot of different levels. Just find out where you can contribute.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, especially in the veteran community, in the military community in general, we have a lot to contribute. There's a lot of lessons that were learned and a lot of skills that we have.
So many unique skills. Exactly. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, so many. And going back to what you were talking about before with the some of the younger folks who, it's like, you know, how do we help these folks out? And it's like, give them a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning. It's like, if you have a skill, you know, maybe it's with animals, maybe it's coaching, maybe it's something else, you know, whatever it is, go and utilize that skill and kind of find your sense of purpose, sense of meaning, out there. Right. I think that's kind of the gist of it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. No, just to be the weight behind America's spear, and you have something to give, find it. Mm-hmm. You know, we need you. America needs you.
You know, I think about a lot of the coaches, like baseball, for example. Let's just use that, right? Think about what that does for a kid. Other than, yeah, sure, the kid gets to go out and have fun, play baseball, right? But they learn about teamwork, right? How to work together as a team. They have that of athleticism, running and swinging a bat and throwing the ball and all these things are skills. Like I've seen people from other countries try to throw a ball and it's freaking hilarious because they have no coordination and they've never done it before. And so they're throwing it and they look like a baby giraffe when it's just born. It's like all awkward and, you know, everything. It's like, that's kind of what they look like. And so, you know, think about, you know, let's take those skills. So maybe you got a, you know, 8, 9, 10 year old, you know, kid on your baseball team that you're coaching. Let's take those skills 10, 15 years later. Now they're in the military. Now they can throw a grenade pretty damn far. Yeah. They can attack people with their rifle, you know, pretty well. They have the athletic skills. They know how to work on a team together. That's a pretty big deal when you think about it. You're like, oh, I'm just coaching a team. Like, yeah, no, it's actually a pretty big deal. Sir.
Always, I've always enjoyed sports and just that team. You know, I had my break in service. So I left the Army in, it was like April 2009. I had a break in service until January of 2011. But that time that I had out, I really missed that team. Mm-hmm. You know, just, I felt like I was sitting on the sidelines and, you know, all the things that was going on in the news all the time. You know, just, I really miss that. I know a lot of people, when they make that transition out of the military, they miss that as well. You know, so that's a great way to fill that void, get involved, go coach a sports team, you know, right. that type of camaraderie with some fellow coaches and that team element to the military, that's very, very similar to what you see in athletics. So get involved.
Yeah, and I've noticed, like, with my own kids playing sports, they at the younger level, it's very much in the kid's mindset, it's very much an individual sport. Like, yeah. I'm just going out there and, you know, I'm just going to go get the ball. And you see, like, on the baseball field, all the kids swarming like cats to the ball,
yeah.
right?
And yeah, they're all together. Yeah, they're wrestling over each other, throwing sand at each other. Oh.
It's like, you guys are on the same team. Just one person, pick up the ball and throw it. Like, that's it. That's all you need to do. But like, as they get older, they start learning, hey, I can rely on these other people. I don't have to go run for that ball. That person's closer to it. He'll get it and he'll throw it to me. And they start to learn that teamwork. And it's amazing as you see them progress and get better at the teamwork aspect. Forget about the sport itself, but just the teamwork and relying on the other team members to be able to do their job, just like you're saying in the emergency room. You need to rely on all those other people. And it's just such a great thing. So, I love that you wrote this book and you're kind of helping shine a light on the fact that there is this sphere that we can be building up, and we can be, putting this weight behind it by helping build up, America's youth and society in general. And, we don't need to have, a lot of the division and all this other crap that's been going on in this country, right?
It's been pretty crazy. It's the most divided. You just look even generationally or politically, as it's been in a very long time. I'm 47. It's the craziest I've ever seen it.
Yeah, I'm not too far off there. It's about as crazy as I've seen it too. So could you share maybe a couple experiences from your book that kind of might highlight some of the kind of things that you're talking about here and what people can expect from it?
Yeah, just some great stories on, how to be the weight behind the spear, and just some different, accountability, overcoming obstacles and decision-making. And there's a couple in there on how to not be the weight behind the spear. So I learned some very, very painful lessons in Texas. I owned a freestanding emergency department. So I owned part of one and didn't make some good choices about the team that I chose to surround myself with. I learned about a year or so into the job, even though we're making crazy money, we're very successful, that I had a CEO that was embezzling money, doing some very sneaky things, writing off lawsuits from other businesses that had crazy allegations of sexual harassment and ridiculousness. And then there was some, what I felt was some problems with Medicare and Medicaid fraud, and had brought those up to the CEO. He owned majority shares in the business. So in Texas, if you don't have majority ownership, you have to tread very lightly. He initially offered me, when I approached him about it, I had applied for a national security position. So the National Security Council, I do emergency management, I'm emergency physician and EMS disaster medicine fellowship board certified. So there were some great opportunities on the National Security Council, and applied. And when you're going for that level of a security clearance, they're asking some questions. And with the business, I got to be honest, I'm like, I cannot... I can't be part of this. So yeah. I went to the CEO, and he went berserk. He offered me a $3.4 million bribe, and I told him to shove it up his rear end. That was fun. Everybody thought I was crazy, but I'm a colonel in the United States Air Force. Yeah, you can't buy me. And I know now that he had been through several lawsuits at other businesses and always bought people off with bribes and then non-disclosure agreements. And he unfortunately ran into the one dude that's going to turn down $3.4 million. So, I had reports into the Texas Department of Insurance and the FBI, and then COVID hit. So he tried to bankrupt the company because he controlled the bank account with majority ownership, just starved everybody out, refused to give distributions. We filed a lawsuit and everything froze. You couldn't get a court date because of COVID. It was just it was a complete nightmare. At the end of the day, he literally threatened my family. He knew I wasn't going to budge. He just got crazier and crazier. And at the end, he sent a henchman from Louisiana. Hey, Josh, you better be careful. He knows some pretty scary people. I'm like, oh. I was rather upset. I take that personal when you threaten my family. So we ended up moving to Australia for a year during COVID, which was super crazy as well, just with our COVID lockdowns.
Sure.
And I just learned some very painful lessons there. The world is not a shiny, happy place, and there's just some bad people. And sometimes you just have to own those losses and just move on. I lost $5 million.
Wow.
Yeah. It is horrific as that is. And, it's been a couple of years now, so I can talk about it without getting super upset. But then February of this year, when you talk about karma, you try to do the right thing and just, take care of your family and do your job. In February, I won the lottery. So
that's awesome.
I literally won the North Carolina Educational Lottery. So at the end of the day, it all comes out in the wash. That good karma comes my way. And we're doing just fine. But, it's not always a shiny, happy place, as most military members know.
Sure.
And you just take care of yourself and, You can't control what other people do. There's going to be some crazy people doing terrible, bad, evil things out there.
Yeah.
And you just take care of yourself and make some decisions for you and your family. And at the end of the day, it all works out.
Wow. That's an amazing story.
It's insane.
Like some
the stories, like the legal stories on there just will blow your mind. The guy was crazy.
At some points during that story that you're saying, I was like, okay, well, this is probably as bad as it gets. And it's like, oh, wait, nope. And now we got henchmen coming after him.
So my wife, it was getting real bad. And I'm a military guy with, some background and some training. And I don't take very kindly to those types of things. So my wife was like, hey, we probably need to get out of here. Something like that's going to happen. Whether it's me or him, like we should probably just remove ourselves from the situation.
Yeah.
So that was Australia.
Wow. Yeah. And of all places, during COVID, winding up in Australia, but
locked down people in apartment complexes for 111 days in Melbourne, like just crazy things.
Yeah. Just crazy stuff was happening, but
yeah.
Anyways, this, all the stuff that we were talking about really has this theme of kind of persisting, despite the odds, all the crap that gets thrown at you. It's improvising, it's adapting, it's overcoming, it's all of those things kind of wrapped in.
That's
one,
what the American military does best.
Yeah.
The Russians in China, they fear it. They have no non-commissioned officer corps. They lack that leadership and the ability to think outside the box. America is very unique, and they fear that.
I was talking the other day to another guest that I had on the show, and we were talking about when you're stateside, things are very regimented, and you kind of have to follow certain procedures and all that kind of stuff. And to some extent, when you're deployed as well, but they loosen the leash a little bit, and you get a little more leeway, a little more freedom to kind of experiment. And if, it's one of those things where if it's stupid, but it works, it's not stupid. So it's like, go ahead. And like, if you get the job done, we don't really care. Like, just go and do it. We may talk to you about it afterwards and be like, well, maybe don't do that again, because that wasn't the safest thing to do. But, if it worked, it worked. And we're not going to hold that against you, right? But it's kind of very similar, I would imagine, to the kind of mindset that you have to have in your line of work, where those split-second decisions, yeah, sure, there's some procedures of things that you absolutely have to do, but you might have to think outside the box for certain things, right?
And you improvise a lot in the decision-making there. Sometimes you're making decisions in very, very complex situations where a decision, you're going to either sacrifice the lung or the kidney or the heart, make a choice. I mean, you would never make that decision independently, but in this situation, you have to make a decision right now or they're going to die.
Right.
And so I'm going to have to sacrifice a little bit of this for this and this certain medication. I have to watch for that. Or maybe, they're a dialysis patient, so that screws everything up. That's why AI, it's great with some things, but in like healthcare with a very complex, just people and decisions and health issues, it's there's no substitute for that training.
Yeah, absolutely. Because those split second decisions, I don't think that there's a computer fast enough right now to be able to make those decisions as fast as a human brain, right? And with that training and experience, and as you were talking, it reminded me of that flight out of New York that ended up landing in the Hudson.
Was it Sully? Captain Sully?
Yeah, Captain Sully. Right. Someone without his experience would have made a different decision, maybe to turn around and go back to the airport or to a different airport, and they wouldn't have made it. They ran all the scenarios. Mm-hmm. Duplicated the whole situation, and every single time it came back as a crash landing, slamming into buildings, into apartments, or wherever, and it wouldn't have worked. The only option that would have worked was what he did and landed it in the river, and it's like, how do you don't train for that type of thing, but it's just instinct.
That's just the years of experience.
Exactly.
Being a captain for so long, there's no substitute. I remember as a physician early on, the things I would learn from attendings and some of these old family practice docs out in rural Nebraska, middle of nowhere, there's no substitute. I mean, you can read every book and you can be super genius and ace all those tests and board exams, but without like 20, 30, 40 years of experience like these guys have. I hope I'm not as grizzled. I mean, I've got 21, 22 years of experience, but there's no substitute for that experience.
Right. And I laugh sometimes because early on in my career, I would work with people who were extremely book smart. They were top of their class in college and, you know, the 4.0 GPA and all that kind of stuff, right? And you say, okay, well, now we have real world situation. Let's sit down and try to figure it out. And they're like, what does a book say? And it's like, sometimes it doesn't matter what the book
says.
The
rubber does not meet the road.
Right.
I've seen so many residents, just these, you know, some brainiacs, some really intelligent individuals that in an emergency department setting, they can't do it. They can't think that quick. They freak out. They don't respond well under pressure. You give them a test, they're going to ace it. But just real life people, it's not. Well, it's
and especially in a situation like you were talking about where certain things might contradict, like you might have to make a decision that sacrifices, a certain organ when you know that that's the thing that's going to keep the person alive, at least, you know, yeah, sure. Maybe it's going to damage something else down the road. That's not a good thing. Obviously, we don't want to do that, but we also want to keep the person alive. That's kind of first and foremost. And when you're talking about those contradictory things, it's like, well, I don't want to hurt the person at all. I don't want to cause any kind of negative impact to the person.
And then in doing that, that's what kills some people.
Right.
So you freeze. You can't make the decision. You have to go one way or another and you freeze and you can't make the decision. And there's repercussions for that.
100%. Yeah. So, a lot of this stuff, I got to imagine talking to you about some of the people who do freeze in that stuff. Some of these things might just be overwhelming. I'm not talking about even in an emergency room. I'm talking about their transition out of the military or, some of that stuff is just overwhelming. Maybe they have anxiety or depression or they're just stressed out about life in general. Do you have any suggestions as far as, immediate steps that you could take when you're feeling overwhelmed, you're feeling like you're about to drown, because you're just overwhelmed with all the things going on in life. How can people start to reframe their situation and kind of take it one step at a time?
Yeah, what you're feeling there is natural. And to a certain extent, it's very normal. Everybody has a breaking point. Now, some people's breaking points are much higher or lower than others. You know, you need to work with special operators that just the breaking points of 99.99% of planet Earth could not do physically or mentally what they do. So everyone's breaking point is a little different, but everyone has a breaking point. And there's nothing wrong with reaching out and talking to friends or family or a healthcare provider. Like the emergency department is always a safe place. You can always go there in any situation if you're having mental health issues. And I take pride in that. Like we are the safety net of this country. And when people have issues, you can always go to an emergency department and talk with somebody that can help you with something. But don't be afraid to ask out. So that's when danger and things get real bad is when you don't know your own limitations or you don't know that breaking point, that's where it gets dangerous. Yeah. And don't be afraid to ask for help. I mean, I learned that as an intern where my first night on call, just paralyzed, like, oh my gosh, I can make a decision to kill somebody if I miss something on an EKG or I give a wrong dose of a medication. But you realize there's people around you. You know, the nurse is always there to make sure you don't make any stupid intern orders and kill somebody, and your attendings and the other senior residents. So no one to ask for help. Like, yeah. You know, doctors don't kill people, but doctors that don't know their limitations kill people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing in the military.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that brings up the just having a support system in place, whether it's family or friends or, colleagues, maybe depending on, where you work and everything. Just having
that weight behind your spear.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's your team. I think every individual, has to look around and be like, look, I can't do everything on my own. As much as I'd love to, you know, sometimes, you know, there are certain times when it's just like, I just want to crawl away in the corner and just let the world leave me alone and everything like that. But I can't do everything. I can't do that. And so, and I know there's folks out there who just want to isolate and be away from everything, but realistically you can't do that. And so looking around at who is around that can help you and, be that support network. Be the person who's there to be like, hey, you doing all right? Like, you kind of seem a little off today. Like, you know, that type of thing. Or even someone that you could just go to and talk to, when you're feeling overwhelmed or you feel like you just need someone to talk to. Right. So
very important.
Yeah. All that I think is it's crucial. I don't think we, get by as a society without it. You know, if we just like, a baseball team, if you had 330 million individuals walking around this country, all doing their own thing and not coming together as a team, even groups of teams, in companies or schools or whatever, to accomplish whatever that mission is that they have, you just have a bunch of individuals. It's going to be just like watching a T-ball game and having 9 kids running after a ball because they don't know what else to do. Right. That's basically what it's going to be like. And it's going to be chaos. So when you have people on your side, people on your team, not only are they there to help you, but you're also there to help them. And everybody gets better. You know, that 1 + 1 doesn't equal 2. It's 3 or more. And that's what you're looking for. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah.
100%. So, awesome. So before we wrap up, I know we've been talking about, a lot of the stuff, kind of resiliency and, building up that group and that community, that weight behind the spear. Can you, let the listeners know where they can find out more information about your work, your book, and, where they can reach out if they want to, or, anything like that?
Yeah. Thank you. WeightBehindTheSpear.com. So WEIGHT, WeightBehindTheSpear.com. We've also started a nonprofit organization, a foundation, the Weight Behind the Spear Foundation, and that's WeightBehindTheSpear/foundation. And people can always reach out on, the social media of Instagram. It's Josh McConkey, MD, and on LinkedIn and Twitter. Twitter is X is McConkey 007.
Awesome.
I'm a James Bond fan.
I kind of guessed. Tell us a little bit about the foundation before we wrap up too. I forgot to mention that.
The foundation, what we saw with Hurricane Helene just decimated a large portion of the country. And in Western North Carolina, I live here in North Carolina, it has just there's entire towns were just wiped off the map. Mm-hmm. So there's been so much damage. The book, Be the Weight Behind the Spear, has had a lot of success, a lot of awards, and it promotes community engagement and volunteerism. And then you see something like that happen. You're like, okay, well now, I want to just write a book, do a bunch of book tour stuff. Like, what can we do with it? So I'm trying to put that into actual practice. We've started a nonprofit organization, a 501c3, we're raising money right now for Western North Carolina. And we're actually putting together a Weight Behind the Spear award each year to draw attention, for the foundation here. But we're going to do a $5,000 annual award every year for, a man or woman that just embodies the Weight Behind the Spear ethos itself. And, we're just getting all that put together right now. But right now, Western North Carolina is hurting and trying to make a difference.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, that area with that hurricane that came through that just kind of decimated that area. And I know some folks who are around that area, maybe not necessarily directly affected by it, but they talk about it and how rough it is over there. And so any support that area can get, but it's great how as a country, we can come together. We saw that after 9/11. We come together and
it's what Americans do best.
This is what we do. People are hurting. We don't need to wait around to be told, go help these people or go help these. Like we know they're hurting and we have resources. We have supplies. We'll bring them and we'll help them and we'll get them back on their feet. It may not be overnight, but it'll be something that will happen.
This is a long-term project. It'll be. Years and years, and in some of those areas, like physically can't be rebuilt. The damage is just so extensive, but you know, this is where we start and we got a lot of work to do.
Yeah, 100%. Well, thank you for the work that you're doing. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing about all the work that you're doing. It's just super important work. Obviously, being a doctor, super important. We need people like you, people who have the mindset and the attitude to be able to work in that emergency capacity. In all capacities of the medical field, I think are super important, but also for the work that you're doing with the foundation to help out, you know, folks who are in desperate need of that help. So
thank you, again. Scott. It has been a pleasure. I appreciate it.